Joseph, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day over in Australia to do this. I know it's reasonably early in the day over there. Before we get into a bit of the conversation today, why don't you just tell us the background, kind of that you're from, and what got you into blood flow restriction training, which is going to be the topic that we're going to discuss today.
Thank you very much, Chris. My name is Joseph. I am an Australian physiotherapist. I have a background in exercise science. I completed my embedded thesis project during my physiotherapy degree on blood flow restriction training in 2014. And at the time, I was intrigued by BFR training probably around 2008, 2009. But when I had the opportunity to do my research project on BFR, I really came to find it really useful. And then noticing that there wasn't a easy sort of general market way of doing BFR training with a device which was easy to use, I took it decided to try to commercialize and develop an idea that I had regarding the wireless system, which is now turned out to be Airbands. So, yeah.
So yeah, I mean that Airband system, I've been lucky enough to use it myself and been and trialing it the last few weeks here. I do think it's a great system. I'm a big fan. Why don't you just go into and tell the listeners that maybe haven't heard of Airbands, a little bit more about it, how it works and how it's different from other blood flow restriction devices on the market.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you. But airbands are inflatable air cuffs. Basically, it's a module of an actuator connected to a bladder, and they inflate. There's a sensor on board which measures arterial flow, and then in the onboard firmware gives you a calculation, and that's all transmitted to the smart device, so phone or tablet, and it works out the pressure that you should be using, and then sets a timer and inflates and then deflates all wirelessly. So yeah, so in terms of other devices on the market, it's just there is a few gold standards, but in terms of price points, they're very expensive, upwards in the ranges of $5,000 to $8,000, and they're wired systems. So for a functional setting, they're just A, maybe a bit too expensive, but B, it's just those wired solutions don't lend themselves to being sort of widespread in a more functional S&C kind of role. So, and I think that really limits the applications of blood flow restriction training in a real life setting. And yeah, so that was kind of the motivation before creating Airbands, was something which was cost effective, useful and easy to use, but then also untethered so it could be used in a functional setting. So like either on the field, in a gym,
And you said, like off camera, just before we started the recording, that it originally started, was it with the ischemic preconditioning?
That's one background of a type of blood flow restriction. But blood flow restriction training, in the form that it's in now, dates back to sort of original conception in 1966. With Dr. Sato, the original founder for the for Katsu, as it's called, so Katsu in Japanese. So that he originated in Japan, and Katsu in Japanese refers to added pressure, I believe. So the Katsu method of training, originated in 1966, and it was quite an interesting story about how he came across that. Basically, he was just kneeling at a monastery, and he realized the feeling that he got in his calves from kneeling for a few hours was the same feeling that he got doing calf raises. And then I believe over the next 7 years or so, he experimented with a number of systems of tying tourniquets around different parts of his body just to elicit a training response. And then through a lot of trial and error, he developed his Katsu system, I believe, and he commercialized it in the late 80s. And by the 1990s, it was being researched widely in Japan. And the original a method of blood flow restriction moderation training originated in Japan with Dr. Sato, and a lot of the first studies were conducted by himself. So very interesting. But it reached prominence in the West, I believe, in the early 2000s, and since then it's really taken off exponentially. in popularity. I'd say most elite training organizations and institutions would at least be aware of blood flow restriction training, or in some degree utilizing blood flow restriction training in some form, either whether it being rehab, either it being performance-based. So I think next 5-year trends, we'll probably see blood flow restriction training being a very normal modality, same as what you get with prescribing different types of exercise prescription or different types of recovery strategies.
That's amazing. Something coming, like the history there, Luffy, and the history behind things, and being able to come up with an exercise or training modality from just kneeling and just seeing it develop, you know?
It is a really interesting story. But he was like, not only very intelligent, but also I think a very avid bodybuilder as well. So I think it was very interesting. And like kneeling and then now creating a system of training, which is basically, because I think blood flow restriction training, the name of it seems almost counterintuitive to what it is. I think that term restriction should be more augmentation or moderation, I think, because you're just augmenting blood flow, you're not restricting it completely. So,
and do you think that name potentially, and it's something I've thought in the past, makes people think, oh, it's maybe not safe, it's dangerous?
Oh, even with like and with health professionals and exercise professionals in the clinical space or in the performance space, who have limited aren't aware of the training background, I think the name can be quite apprehensive, I believe, because it does, I imagine, to it does come across as quite strong in terms of, oh, this doesn't seem right that you should be doing that. But I think a few people have referred to it as blood flow moderation training, which seems a little bit more accurate to what it is. But yeah, I think restriction training is probably, it's going to stick, unfortunately, or fortunately, because it is accurate to some degree.
Yeah. I think that, and that's where as well, like from my experience using the airbands comes in, because it's got a built-in like blood pressure test essentially at the end of the day. And that's what is obviously makes it unique as well. It's an automated system. You click, it couldn't be easier. You click go on the app. Essentially, it activates, inflates, takes your blood pressure reading for the day, and then gives you, based on your, I suppose, individual preparedness for the day, gives you a blood pressure resistance setting for your workout that day. Is that right? I haven't got anything wrong there, have I?
The pressure sensor on board, converts those vibrations to those pulsations to an electrical signal, and it gives you the amount of pressure required to restrict that limb in that moment. So it does vary hydration levels, day-to-day activities, stress and whatnot. So I think having that personalized pressure just as a level of safety. But interestingly, they did a Nakajima 2006 and to 2017 was a follow-up paper looking at, I believe, 300,000 katsu sessions in Japan. And over that 10-year period, the risk of injury or adverse effects were very minuscule. I'd say even some instances less than 1%. I think it was less than 1%. So, and there was no deaths in that 10-year period with the BFR group, which my memory serves me correct. But even with conventional exercise, there's 1 in 10,000 deaths.
Right.
So it seems to be very safe from what the literature has shown so far. But the naming convention could be maybe looked at. But I think keeping the pressures personalized to the user and not setting arbitrary pressures is probably something very useful.
That was something that I was actually impressed with when I was using it. I used it one day, then I used it the next day, and my pressure was different. And I was kind of wondering, I was like, oh, what's going on? But then I realized, obviously, it was individualizing my pressure depending on my readiness for the day, like you said, hydration level. Whereas if you look at potentially other systems, then you've got to stick to an arbitrary pressure, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So, and yeah, and based on the hydration levels, stress levels, and number of different factors, yeah, that pressure level can change day to day. So I think, recommended probably would be doing the calibration as often as possible when utilizing blood flow restriction training, just to keep it, like, the risks of low, but keeping it safe as possible would be a good idea. But I think the definition of safety is, like, something I tend to bring up with a lot of people, because I think as people get aware of a method, it's either they completely not on board, or completely on board. So I'm a pendulum swing quite rapidly. But I would say blood flow restriction training is useful when it's useful, but it's not. It shouldn't be prescribed to everyone uniformly. So it's basically it should be a tool which fits inside your toolbox, which you can prescribe for particular reasons. But generally, it looks like it can be used in a number of different ways. But I think safety is the balance between risk and benefit. So, like, if you think for a particular athlete the benefit outweighs the risk, then blood flow restriction training is completely safe. But that applies to every current modality that a strength coach would be using, because, like, even applying a ice bag, a cryotherapy, has 20 contraindications for use, which people will probably aren't super aware of. So, like, even a heat pack has, I believe, I think 19 or 20 contraindications as well.
Right, that's really interesting, actually. Do you mind going, because obviously blood flow restriction started with essentially strength training and strength training predominantly, and then latterly there's been one or two studies coming out just more on aerobic benefits of training as well. To start with, though, before we get into that, do you mind just going into some of the science behind like the strength training modalities that have typically been used? I know there's a few different studies out there saying this protocol's the best, like kind of the best hormonal response and things like that. Do you mind just going into some of the details about that, just for the listeners that maybe don't know?
Yeah. So in terms of the protocols, a number of different rep ranges have been prescribed in application and at pressure times. But what seems to be landed on largely in the literature is kind of four sets to relative sort of volatile failure. So the traditional, like what seems to be the traditional blood flow restriction application for strength and hypertrophy is four sets, 30 reps for the first set, a rest period of 30 seconds, followed by three sets of 15. That's sort of the uniform. But whether those numbers are magical is probably not the case. So whether you do 29 reps or 14 reps, but essentially I think it's a application time where enough metabolic accumulation can occur in the limb to signal a hormonal response to the body, or to signal a response to the body that exercise has occurred to a high rate, and then causing those anabolic pathways to improve strength and hypertrophy. So basically, I think I liken it to there's an oxygen mismatch in the limb, and the body thinks that a lot of work has occurred. And then basically, as it would do with traditional mechanical stress, it would improve strength and hypertrophy. But instead of mechanical stress, you've used a metabolic stress. So like a seesaw. So I imagine with a traditional strength training at 80% 1RM, there's a high mechanical stress of if you follow the actin-myosin breakdown theory, but then there's a low maybe metabolic stress. But with BFR, it's a high metabolic stress and a low mechanical stress. So I think it's kind of, you get to the same place, but how you do that, it's via different sort of pathways.
Yeah, and then some of the other research that I've read around it as well is obviously increase in growth hormone response. And I can't remember the number off the top of my head. Maybe you can help me out here, but the like considerably more growth hormone has been produced kind of post-exercise as a result of blood flow restriction training when compared to like your conventional weight training.
Yeah, I'd say like in terms of the acute hormonal response or anabolic hormone response, testosterone and IGF growth factors, I think it's always interesting to delineate between like acute and chronic. So if obviously an acute increase in IGF-1 or an acute increase in testosterone is interesting, but then whether that's the actual mechanism for why BFR training is maybe effective, because I imagine for testosterone to be effective long-term for producing muscle strength and size, you're probably not taking one dose of testosterone. And so if that makes sense. So
yeah, for sure.
So I think it's really interesting that those pathways, those anabolic hormones increase, but whether they're 100% responsible for the results that you see, I'm less certain of that. But yeah, this paper is looking at, I think, a 56% improvement in muscle protein synthesis post-exercise with BFR training, increases in testosterone and IGF growth factors. And then, but I think what seems to be more correlated with the results with BFR maybe might to do with sort of more sort of factors which may be correlated more with, say, training, so like cortisol or norepinephrine or whatnot. So basically, they from what I've read, seem to also be associated with improvements in strength and hypertrophy, but which will mean basically that, yeah, however they affect adaptation pathways. So basically, that kind of makes sense to me on some level that they might be responsible for as well. But the downregulation of some papers have looked at the downregulation of myostatin, which is a protein inhibitor, which is a protein which inhibits muscle growth and whatnot. So if you downregulate that, you theoretically get more muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I think it's really, I'd say thus far, they haven't been able to completely have one roadmap to what's actually happening to cause the strength and the strength hypertrophy adaptations you see.
Yeah, I think there's so many different things obviously going on there, the different chemical pathways that are going on. It's so hard to pinpoint, exactly the same with the aerobic stuff as well, what is exactly causing this effect. Like you say, you've got the decrease in myostatin, you've got the upregulation of protein synthesis.
I'll say this one paper in 2014 by Cook looked at, I think, 19 or 20 rugby players, and they had, one group was completing their strength conditioning program, 70% 1RM, bench press, squat, pull up. I can't remember the other exercises they had, but it was just a general sort of conditioning program. And then one group was doing the same conditioning program at 70% 1RM, but they had blood flow restriction applied to the thighs. So the same program, but just one had blood flow restriction applied to the thighs. And there was about, I want to say, a 5.5% improvement in bench press strength at the end of the 3 weeks with the BFR group compared to the control group. So and a few other lower limb metrics improved, which is more which is less surprising. But the fact that they had a improvement in a area which wasn't under direct blood flow restriction, and there's a few papers out there which have shown the same things in terms of doing arm curls with leg blood flow restriction applied to one leg and training the other leg. There's a few interesting again, the pathways around what's happening there, they've sort of, whether it's basically those anabolic hormones or basically go into the complete systemic system, and that they just go to the area which is under work, or it's particular types of growth factors, so vascular endothelial growth factors or responsible for blood vessel growth or whatnot. So I don't think you'll be able to get one solid answer to what's actually happening to cause the distal results would be a little bit more easier to understand, I imagine, but then the proximal result would be how is that actually working.
Yeah, I think that's actually fascinating when you look at that, you're getting that whole body systemic effect from including the legs, and then you're getting obviously like the bench press improvements as well. And I think that's something that
I was just going to say on that, NASA or space agencies have been using a type of blood flow restriction, not for muscle mass retention, but they have explored that pretty recently though. So NASA, since 2012, has explored blood flow restriction training with attenuating muscle loss associated with astronauts. But prior to that, with a lot of their space missions, they wear these things called bracelets, I believe, B-R-A-S-L-E-T. And basically they're tourniquets which get applied to the upper legs to astronauts in space, but it's to maintain cardiovascular health. So as you imagine, in a microgravity environment, blood doesn't circulate the way that it should, and pooling can occur easily in the distal limbs because blood coming out of the heart is under high pressure, but blood returning back to the heart only really occurs via muscle movements. So it needs muscle contractions to force the blood back to the heart. So I imagine a lot of astronauts get blood pooling in the distal limbs, and those cuffs help with maintaining their cardiovascular health. But it just goes to show like it's like how it's working could be related to augmentations to the to the blood shifting systems in the body, and that causes some sort of signaling pathway when combined with exercise. But yeah,
that's amazing as well. I did not know that. But I think as well with the current kind of situation that everyone in the world's dealing with the coronavirus and kind of being isolated and things like that, and a lot of people not having access to gyms or any weight of any kind or anything like that, and being solely kind of down to body weight training to an extent for the vast majority of us. And this is obviously a great opportunity to use like blood flow restriction training to be able to tap into those, I suppose, to stop muscle atrophy to a degree. And if not, get a little bit stronger and kind of progress potentially through a little bit of hypertrophy as well. And I think that's one of the big things that I think some coaches are definitely using that at the moment. I think more definitely could. Moving on with that, do you think, I've read a few different things around muscle damage to do with like blood flow restriction training. I've heard that muscle damage can be increased, but it can also be decreased depending on, but I suppose, the exercise protocol. Obviously, if you're training to failure, you'd imagine you would be getting more muscle damage as a effect. Do you have to train to failure in order to get the best responses from blood flow restriction training? Or is that, I know we mentioned that other protocol earlier, that protocol that you mentioned earlier, the 30, 15, 15, 15, that might be training to failure for some people. Likewise, it might not. So I've played around with that protocol myself. Do you mind just going into a little bit of the details behind like the muscle damage?
Yeah, I'd say first off, in terms of the application times, I'll definitely err on starting on the lower threshold of the amount of resistance that you're using, and then the lower threshold of pressure being applied. So there's arbitrary prescription pressures in the literature. Also, there's arbitrary pressures sort of prescribed, which is kind of like 50% your personalized pressure zone, so your arterial occlusion pressure, and then training at 40% your 1 RM. But again, for an untrained individual, that could be a way too much stimuli. And whereas they could do 20% their 1 RM and then train at 30% their arterial occlusion pressure and still get a training effect. So I think the same applications for exercise prescription generally, as in like what would you generally apply to a novice, intermediary or advanced exercise lifter, would be the same application with blood flow restriction training. I think fine tuning it. So doing, basically being like, okay, yeah, I tried doing 4 sets of push-ups underneath blood flow restriction of 50% my arterial occlusion. It was way too hard. It was painful and I couldn't do it. Would suggest that load is too high. So I think using that 4 sets to technical failure or 4 sets, I personally wouldn't err on the idea of volatile failure, because I believe it's the same as going into the gym and trying to do as many reps as you can with an exercise. You are going to get sore, and it's not a scalable way of training, I don't believe either. Whereas I think the same progressive overload strategies have to apply to blood flow restriction as well, but you're using the restriction pressure as a an added added lever in terms of the overload mechanisms. So if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I think that's by using obviously like training age, just like any strength conditioning coach would, being able to like adapt around that. Is there any guidelines on that, or is it just kind of?
Unfortunately, not that I've seen. The most recent sort of systematic reviews or the position paper are basically a summary of what sort of a commentary or summary of what's already happened. And in the literature, it varies between volatile failure, training with 3 sets of 15, 4 sets of 15, continuous intermittent use. It's just, I think that's why, like, I think as the ability of BFR training can be more mainstream, strength coaches who are acutely aware of where that athlete is can record and use a number of case series to help develop those protocols in terms of exercise prescription. Which I think is very useful. But my recommendation would be start at a very low restrictive pressure and start at a very low percentage of 1RM. Mm-hmm. And I would also say as 1RM is higher, your restrictive pressures are lower. And as 1RM is lower, restrictive pressures are higher. So it's that seesaw effect, I believe. So you're always getting
that inverse relationship between the two.
So obviously, high restrictive pressure and high resistance pressure would be counterintuitive. It would be too much load, and you're completing it not effectively. Mm-hmm. And then too much is you're basically not achieving the same response. So I think either one or the other. So I think that seesaw analogy probably extends itself quite well across the spectrum. But as I'd say, if a strength coach applying BFR training for the first time with an athlete of training age, then just applying 20% 1RM and 20% restriction and completing an exercise and seeing how they react to that, and then progressively, slowly over the next 6 weeks or so, increasing the percentage of 1RM and increasing the restrictive pressures to a point where they feel the athlete is getting the appropriate amount of responses to that training modality, and not getting a disproportionate amount of muscle pain or discomfort.
Okay.
But I'll caution, BFR training is still a training method. It's still a stress on the body. It's definitely less, it'd be less stress, but it's still a stress. So doing too many sessions at once may cause a cortisol blunted reaction to training, as in like, you may not get the best benefits from that. So basically like being cautious about how much load or how much stimulus the athlete's getting would also be useful. That's kind of what I'll say around that.
And on that, is there any difference in kind of frequency of training compared to traditional training techniques? So maybe 3 times per week, or how would you go about that?
It tends to be largely for more apparently healthy, recreationally fit populations. 3 days a week tends to be what's largely prescribed. In more athletic populations, I think I've read 2 sessions a week, maybe up to four times a week. It's less mechanical stress, and as long as you're cautious about how much load is occurring to the athlete, you can possibly cross training around different body parts and different types of exercise. You may be able to do more, but I'd say 3 days a week with BFR training seems to be an effective way of improving muscle strength and size. But I've read one study which was done 6 days in a row with blood flow restriction, and which led to some pretty significant results in bench press strength and size in the not only in the triceps but also in the pecs.
Right. Okay. So it is systemic, full body, getting the effect from that, not just that occluded area, as you said earlier. Go on. Sorry.
No, I'd say the in terms of the systemic effects, I would imagine the closer the restriction is to the body part you're wishing to target, that makes sense that it may be more useful. So say if you're targeting more proximal trunk muscles, the pecs, having them on the upper arm makes sense. And if you're targeting the glutes, maybe having them on the upper leg, like. But I think the literature as it emerges for more trunk based exercises is very interesting.
Just out of interest, and it's just something that's popped into my head now, if you were to target more like the calf musculature and things like that, could you occlude lower down the quad? Would that be more beneficial than higher up the quad?
Well, no. So you can. I wouldn't advise about not applying the cuffs to different body parts, mainly for the reason is around your knee, the nerves and arteries are very superficial. So particularly around your fibula head, and you can get a lot of shearing around those. So as the compression goes, you could get a lot of high pressure areas around sensitive nerves. So if you are going to experience any issues, it's more likely the case around more bony prominences. Whereas with the upper arm or upper thigh, the veins and the arteries and nerves are very deep. So they're well padded. So there's less shearing and stress. And because the way arteries work, basically it's the same it's the same blood flow down. So basically, if you're restricting the upper thigh, you're still restricting the calf. So and it's much safer as well. So I would recommend having the thigh calf high underneath the inguinal fold and doing your calf exercises. But yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, calf raises with blood flow restriction suck a lot. They're really And one paper came out last year, at the end of last year, I believe, and it showed similar tendon changes, characteristics of the tendon, with 30% 1RM calf raises, I believe it was seated calf raises with BFR, compared to 80% 1RM calf raises with not BFR. And basically, the assumption was it could be useful for tendinopathies or tendon issues, mm-hmm. But tendons are very difficult to load and rehabilitate from, because introducing load is very difficult. Whereas BFR, it also seems to show an analgesic effect as well, with some interesting research coming out of showing decreases in pain acutely with anterior knee pain in particular. So it seems to have an analgesic effect, plus now maybe some tendon improvements. So that it seems to be maybe quite an interesting method for tendinopathies and tendon complaints as well, loading more sensitive athletes.
Well, I've actually seen on that as well. I think there's some research came out, I think recently, to do with blood flow restriction during isometric contractions. So sitting in squat, for example, and that's where I think a lot of the analgesic effect is coming from.
The isometric holds tend to cause like a nociceptor reaction where it can decrease pain acutely. So a lot of tendons, that's a protocol, a lot of tendons protocols are prescribed. But so I think the applications, say for a strength coach or whatnot, in terms of like, okay, yeah, BFR training seems useful, but then how do I apply it? I think it's a continuum. So for start off with, I imagine if you have a recently acute athlete who's maybe had an injury of some sort, it'd be passive use with blood flow restriction, either combined with isometric exercises or just sort of having cycles of blood flow restriction on and off. Because a paper by in 2000 came out, and it had two sessions of 25 minutes of blood flow restriction led to 50% less atrophy after their ACL reconstruction in that particular study. So there's not a great deal of literature supporting that, but that seems quite interesting application. So basically, passive use of blood flow restriction, and when the athlete is able, progressing to walking or progressing to cycling, so basically maintaining muscle mass and cardiovascular fitness, and then combining that with isometric exercises or even electrical stimulation, and then when they're able to, low load resistance training, so 30% 1RM body weight or doing some sort of external load, and then when they're able to again progress again to more traditional resistance training. But the interesting thing about BFR training could be for an athlete who has a lower limb injury who still wants to be loaded aerobically. At the moment, like with my background working with Australian football, like if someone had an ankle injury, having them effectively load their aerobic system was very difficult. So they were doing upper body battle rope, upper body boxing. But and we also did a lot of stuff with the Ultra G machine, the treadmill, the buoyancy treadmill, to get them back and sort of track running and moving. But with blood flow restriction, you can apply the cuffs. One study by Abe et al. In 2010 had compared 15 minutes of indoor of cycling with under blood flow restriction for, at 40% VO2 max versus 45 minutes of cycling not under blood flow restriction at 40% VO2 max. And at the end of the 3 weeks, they were doing three sessions a week. I want to say there was a 6.4% improvement in the BFR group for improving VO2 max. And they were training at 50, they were doing one third the time on the bike and only training at 40% their VO2 max, but they improved their overall VO2 max by 6.4%. Right. So it was less time, less load, and they got a pretty significant improvement in VO2 max.
So there is definitely more like research coming out to do, because that was leading on to my other question as well, to do with the aerobic system and development on kind of that end of things. Like, what else can we do like with the cuffs in terms of, like you've just said, was that, do you know if that was, did that group undergo strength training as well? Because usually,
if you bear with me for a second, actually, a gentleman from came in yesterday and we actually chatted about it and I typed a few things up just so it'd be useful for them. But I don't believe they did measure strength in that study, but the only exercise intervention was cycling. So in that study, time to exhaustion increased by 15.4%, quadricep strength increased by 7.7%, and quadricep cross-sectional muscle mass area increased by 3.4%.
That's interesting, because you're still managing to work there. I think you stated 40% of VO2 max. Now that's a good, and especially the interesting thing there obviously is like cycling. Now if we look at the research to do with more of the interference effect with like the kind of the blunted adaptations to strength training, usually you get those elevated levels of AMPK obviously from aerobic exercise. But typically, if you can stay definitely below 50% of VO2 max, then that AMPK is going to be relatively like suppressed. So that's actually really interesting to see there, that we can use blood flow restriction training to train at real low levels of VO2 max and still obviously get those strength training adaptations that we're looking for as well.
Recently, I haven't read the paper yet, but it was emailed to me. I think a paper came out looking at the femoral artery diameter increasing with blood flow restriction, and then that being a mechanism for increasing lactate. Some lactate clearance, although I think one of the outcomes was related to lactate and basically improving aerobic capacity via that mechanism. Being able to train at a level which is not enough to limit. I think a way of introducing the beneficial exercise stimuli without the negative effects of, say, overtraining is very interesting to me. Like I think particularly from those studies, because they either look at a percentage of VO2 max or a percentage of HRR or a different mechanism of cardiac output, but they typically look at like 40 to 50% of that. So you're doing half the maximum intensity, but you're getting quite significant results. So I think it wouldn't replace high intensity training, but it could definitely supplement it.
Yeah, and I think, but that's huge as well in terms of if you've got athletes coming through that return to play protocol and we're trying to get them back ideally as quick as possible without putting them under any due like risk, we've got to obviously be able to condition them as well and get them up to speed. So if we can combine and use blood flow restriction training to improve their aerobic capacity while obviously pushing their strength gains as well, then it's potentially a win-win for everyone.
I think that cross training aspect is like the most one of the most useful user cases, I believe. Like it's because it's in a situation where you're very limited of what you can prescribe, it lends itself to being very adaptable.
Mm-hmm. And especially if we've got someone that's maybe injured in the lower body, for example, and we need to do some hand bike exercise we could potentially occlude the upper arm and then get those full body effect as well.
And there is papers looking at rowing as an outcome measure, and there was quite significant results in that as well. So I think upper body cardiovascular, lower body cardiovascular seems to be correspond quite nicely, which is really interesting. It's really good that the literature supports that and is ever evolving, because it just lends itself to, I think the user cases are going to get wider and wider. But I think that space where you have an athlete who may have a ankle instability, you're like, oh, okay, how do I load them aerobically? What can I do? You can either invest in a $150,000 Ultra G treadmill. You can try to do some water-based exercises. You can do cross-body, so like hand boxing or whatnot. Or you can get them in a moon boot doing some cycling on a bike. Mm-hmm. Like, or you could do get them on a moon boot doing cycling on a bike under blood flow restriction. Like, it's cost-effective. It's safe. It's potentially very beneficial, and it's easy to implement.
100%. I love it. It makes me realize that I didn't do that with one of my athletes who had a fractured fibula earlier in the year. I should have, now looking back, what an idiot. Should have occluded his legs a little. Like, he did that with the with our athletic trainer to do his strength development and things like that for his lower body. But when he came into the weight room, it makes me think, like, I should have occluded his lower body, and we could have got him on the bike and things like that as well, in his boot, or got him on the ski erg and things like that as well. So that's definitely something to take home from me.
Yeah. Even as an athlete or whatnot, I know, like, psychologically as well, as in, like, I imagine, like, physical conditioning is really important, obviously, but also psychological conditioning is really important. You have an athlete who physically is not being loaded to the same level that they were previously, and then mentally maybe feels more fragility. I think blood flow restriction training, like, when you do particularly an aerobic session, it's not easy at all. And you're still, for an athlete, I imagine, who's used to training hard, doing a rehab program probably is very not ideal for them, because they feel as though they're not pushing themselves hard enough. So even with BFR training, you get I imagine some level of a high intensity workout. So I imagine that lends itself to improving confidence and improving mental wellness, but improving basically having that athlete more engaged in their training program. And in basically, I think it's very useful for the fact of, like, the ability to do a lot of work without compromising your recovery period.
And I think as well, like you touched on it there, is that's one of the biggest things as part of the return to play and rehab process. It's that mental and emotional well-being. And if they feel like they're getting more kind of more out of the program by being able to maybe come to the weight room when the other members of the team are in the weight room instead of going to the training room, then they're going to feel so much better during that period.
Funny you mentioned that, because a lot of literature looking around injured workers, that's basically the gold standard, is getting them back to the work site immediately, just for their mental well-being, even though they can't, they have restrictions physically. And that leads to a exceptionally increased return to work, just by being back in the work environment quicker.
Yeah, and they want to get back quicker, and they feel great. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I think something that we sometimes forget as strength coaches is generally that stress is stress. It doesn't matter what it is. It can be like environmental stress, emotional stress, whatever, like your relationships and stuff. But at the end of the day, it's all the same. The brain perceives it as the same thing. And the quicker you can get over that stress and get back to doing what you love to do, then the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of athletes, I don't imagine, I don't know, we're sticking to the sort of the acute side of it, but I think, overcoming an injury is a large, particularly for an athlete who's on the cutting edge of physical performance, going back from then scaling back to not being able to weight bear appropriately or even walk comfortably. I think, there's something there to explore, particularly. To get them, doing something where they feel though that they're still working out, they're accelerating their results or even maintaining their muscle and still getting an effective workout. I think something to explore there, definitely. But so that's the acute side, but there's also the more chronic side of what. One study in 2019 had blood flow restriction applied to. I want to say Norwegian, but it could have been a different Scandinavian country. Basically, they're elite powerlifters, and they did two blocks of blood flow restriction, not concurrently. So I think it was week 2 and 4, or they could have, there was definitely a week in between where they didn't do blood flow restriction training as part of their 6 week squat program. At the end of the 6 week, the BFR group who did the 30% front squat exercise week 2 and week 4, I think it was. I may have got that wrong, but it was two weeks of the 6 week program, improved muscle size by, I think, 4.7%. It was quite a significant amount, and the control group didn't improve muscle size at all. So both groups didn't improve strength, but you'd assume elite powerlifters are probably at their height, at their strength threshold. But it was interesting that they, one, the BFR group improved hypertrophy. So even in elite athletes who you assume would be at their peak of muscle mass, strength, there was still a threshold for hypertrophy to occur. So I think, yeah, the usefulness of blood flow restriction training, what I'm trying to get at is strength athletes in the middle of the season who are playing games on the weekends, or playing one or two games a week or whatever it is, can't obviously do as many strength conditioning sessions in the gym. And I imagine as the season progresses, they lose muscle mass and weight overall. So BFR training could be a useful way to supplement a weight session in the middle of a season, maintain muscle mass, or maintain or even put on muscle mass during the season. So, and I think that's where I see it for a healthy athlete. That would be a really good application, I would say.
Especially if you manipulate some of those variables and obviously don't take them to failure as well, then you're not getting the muscle damage and the soreness that potentially, like soccer players, for example, hate.
Yeah, I could imagine. Exactly. Yeah. So that would be how I would see inter-season use. And in the preseason, it would be maybe to do around tendons or rehab or maybe like more supplemental sessions, or with the players that can't engage in strength training, or more aged players who have a few conditions which limit them from doing a lot of training. So I think load sensitive. Sorry, I was after, but I think the interseason use would be, yes, supplemental, because I know even if they're not injured, a lot of players are probably quite sore or have niggly pains. So getting in the weight room probably be quite of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. So just to go back to something that you touched on, you mentioned obviously muscle hypertrophy, which is where I'd imagine a lot of people first came across blood flow restriction training, because they want massive biceps and to get jacked and things like that. So, but like from my personal perspective, I work with a lot of like power athletes. So at the moment I work with tennis players, but I've got a rugby background myself. I played a lot of rugby. I've worked with a lot of rugby athletes. Now, obviously in terms of power development, we're looking at more like fast twitch type 2 fiber development in particular. So, and I know I'm really interested in this area, is if we can occlude the thigh or whatever it is, and you're doing your squats, for example, does it essentially, by kind of occluding, creating that hypoxic environment, you've kind of taken the oxygen away, you fatigue the slow twitch fibers more quickly, therefore recruiting those higher threshold motor units, tapping into those type 2 fibers. First of all, is that correct what I've said? And then do you mind kind of going into that in a little bit more detail, please?
Yeah, so that's what you suggested, what the proposed mechanism is of the oxygen mismatch. The aerobic pathways are no longer working sufficiently, and then you're creating an anaerobic environment where basically only the local energy systems are available to the muscle, and that causes the preferential recruitment of the fast twitch muscle fibers, which respond to hypertrophy and strength at a 40% greater threshold or greater rate than fast twitch. Type 1 or type A slow twitch muscle fibers. So that's what is proposed of how it works. So that's really interesting. So I think it follows that preferential recruitment principle. So basically, it bypasses that preferential recruitment principle, right? Because I imagine for low threshold tasks, top slot nutrient fibers are preferentially recruited. As it increases in complexity or demands, it goes to more fast twitch muscle fibers. But yeah, blood flow restriction training seems to change that. But in terms of what muscle fibers hypertrophy and not, it's actually been a bit mixed though, because some studies have shown that there is responses in type slow twitch muscle fibers and then fast twitch muscle fibers. So it's been a bit mixed, but it may have to do with the, so what I was getting at, we can probably go back to that powerlifter study, was they may have already been at their threshold of fast twitch muscle fiber growth. And the new stimuli may have, but then they may have not been at their threshold for slow twitch muscle fiber improvement. So that could have been why at least we saw the improvement in that type of muscle fiber.
Could that depend on that? We talked about earlier the seesaw effect of kind of the load intensity and the occlusion pressure. Could that kind of play an effect as well?
Yeah, in terms of what muscles are recruited in what exercises. So it's, yeah, so that, in terms of the breakdown of slow twitch versus fast twitch, it may be dependent on the athlete and where their profile is. It may be dependent on what type of exercises are occurring or the demands. It may depend on the muscle activation. But at a very high level, the preferential recruitment principles of slow to fast twitch is seemingly, even on a like benchmark kind of analysis of it, would be curb because of the oxygen mismatch, basically, and you're creating an and that's basically how those the metabolic accumulation is proposed that it occurs is from creating an anaerobic environment where basically those muscle byproducts aren't going anywhere and not being cleared. So the body then identifies that, hey, we've noticed that all these phosphates and inorganics are accumulated in the limb. What's going on here? Obviously, you've completed high intense exercise. Let's now adapt to this.
Interesting. And then that kind of, that just reminds me of, if you look at someone like Werner Günther, who was a shot putter and essentially a freak of an athlete. I don't know if you've came across him. I think it was back in the, I want to say like 80s, could be wrong. But some of the research around him that I've heard is he was actually like only 37% fast twitch, which is quite ridiculous, really. It's pretty low. I think usually marathon runners are around 47% and things like that, like fast twitch, yeah. Like a reasonably even distribution. But then when they did muscle biopsies off him, what was interesting, I think he was up to somewhere in the region of 83 to 87% fast twitch fiber cross-sectional area on his whole body.
Oh, okay, wow.
Which is phenomenal. I'm sure he was taking a few other substances along the way. But that's definitely something to think about. And that's what kind of got me thinking to do with the occlusion training. If we can maximize those adaptations of the fast twitch fibers, and especially as well, when we go back to the talking about aerobics, the aerobic side of it, if we can improve the oxidative capacity of those type 2 fibers as well, then that's going to be so much more beneficial for power athletes.
Very interesting, particularly for a modality which is quite easy to implement, and there's no minimal risks of basically, like, I imagine for a number of strength coaches and whatnot, running a trial and basically just doing 3 weeks of a particular exercise and just having those metrics recorded and just running small case series and being like, did this work? Was this beneficial? And I think that would be the best application, because like the literature is supported. Supporting a lot of aerobic and strength, but in terms of particular user cases, like you were mentioning, say with more skill-based sports, more specific user cases, I think it would be up to the strength coach to implement a protocol which they have trialed and just basically in that particular user case, because you're so halocracy is the term that they use. Basically, the best person to make a decision is the person who's closest to the problem. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I know we talked about this off camera, just so the listeners kind of know what we're talking about here when you talk about skill development. Like we've looked at potentially using like occlusion training within more sport specific training. Now, I know I mentioned to you that one of my friends over in the UK, Stefan Jones, uses a similar thing with his fast bowlers in cricket and gets some really good specific adaptations. Do you mind just quickly going into some of the reasons that he might be seeing some of those adaptations?
Yeah, I'm really interested in that skill-based application because I think it's really interesting because, like, improving a baseball player's bat speed, I imagine, or power with hitting a ball, using a weighted bat wouldn't be the exact way of going about it, I don't imagine, because you're changing the dynamics of the movement. So adding in a heavier bat wouldn't really necessarily be the same. So same thing with a golf swing, like using a heavier club or whatever that is, or trying to load that movement, you change the overall movement. Yep. And same thing with pitching
kinematics.
Yeah, changing the movement kinematics and then pitching a baseball, bowling, same thing. But if you can introduce a metabolic load, which doesn't interfere with the kinematics of the movement, but it still applies a training stimulus. So you're basically loading them internally, almost, I imagine, via the metabolic system. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting because you're adding load, you're fatiguing them. They're training specifically to what they want to improve. I think that may hold a lot of merit. I could see that being, like, say an example could be if you had a baseball pitcher, and I imagine if they're pitching at 100% their max speed, they're gonna hurt the shoulder. I imagine so. They probably would be. They would want to limit that load. But if you have a baseball pitcher and they're pitching at 30% their max speed, and you measure that with a terminal velocity, sort of like a radar gun or whatever that is,
yep,
and they pitch 30% with blood flow restriction, I don't know what the outcome would be, but I'll be very curious of the results.
And I think as well, if you look at someone, so in kind of my world with tennis, for example, on a serve, they potentially don't have to train as fast on the serve or whatever it is. Like, we had a big thing this year called Big Serve Wednesday, and we tracked the velocity of the serves for the guys. And that was a big thing just to try and get them to understand, okay, you think you're training fast. Now I've got the speed gun out. I'm standing at the other side of the net. And to be fair, I took a few hits, but it makes it a bit more competitive for them and it allows them to get after it. And now if you put that stimulus or the cuff on it as well, then it's, you're not necessarily using a weighted racket or anything like that, but it's just another way of overloading that movement. And I like that a lot. That could be something to look into.
Yeah, overloading the movement. And I'd be very curious to see what, because it's like, because SNC, like doing the, like if you do your SNC too close to, so if you try to mimic what you're doing in the weights room to the sport, you might as well just do the sport, I imagine, right? Like there's a threshold there where it becomes less beneficial of doing it in the weights room where you do it in on the field or on the tennis court. So, but I imagine adding in SNC into the field-based or court-based training would be like quite useful and easy to implement.
I think so. And I think there'll be a good element of buy-in from the athlete there as well, because they, like, no matter what your athlete is, they love that sports specificity vibe. If it looks like the skill, they think it improves the skill, even though that's not always the case.
So, but I think the role of strength and conditioning is very interesting, because my position is it builds general strength and resilience. Mm-hmm. And then the sports specific stuff occurs on the field, but obviously depends on what sport you're playing and whatnot. So you should bring elements of the sport into the weights room as well. It's very interesting where that, like, it's because that's I imagine you probably run into that most days, I imagine, of like how that works.
For sure, and it's very much like, let's get the general right first, build that resiliency and robustness, because an injured athlete's useful to no one. So it's get them healthy, get them on the field. And then once we've got a good base of general physical preparedness, then we can start looking towards our maybe more specialized developmental and stuff like that. And you build the foundations on top of each other, if that makes sense.
One interesting application for BFR last year that I read a paper was proposed including it in introduction of BFR in a dynamic warm-up as part of, instead of doing a resistance training session prior to a performance to get some neural activation, applying blood flow restriction. I think that study looked at applying blood flow restriction and combined with a lunge exercise, and the outcome measure they used was a counter movement jump. Mm-hmm. And I believe it improved 15 minutes after the lunge exercise with BFR. It improved flight time by almost 5%, I think, 4.9%.
Wow. That was actually, you read my mind. That was where my next question was going to go. And I was going to say, okay, so can we use, because we're managing to tap into like type 2 fibers and things like that, which have got higher levels of output, can we use occlusion training in our warm-ups? No matter, I'm not sure what the protocol would be, because you obviously don't want to create fatigue, but you to create this acute response to training, kind of like we do with post-activation potentiation. So can we use occlusion training to potentiate our kind of match day performance or our practice and things like that?
One paper in 2016 actually looked at one application where you're applying blood flow restriction prior to activity in an attempt to improve activation and recruitment pathways and improving performance, or at least, yeah. And then the other one would be the application of blood flow restriction training after an exercise. So one study in 2016, I believe, was Taylor. It had cyclists apply sprint interval training. I think it was 30-second intervals combined with blood flow restriction straight after. And that led to, I think, about a 4.5% improvement in VO2 max at the end of the 4 weeks.
Right.
So, yeah. So that's why, like, in terms of the question regarding application, it's because there's so much varying amount of literature, it becomes hard to, not hard, but like, if you ask me specifically, how would I apply it for this sport? That question is very broad in a way, because the literature supports bits and pieces of applications, but it wouldn't support, say, that gentleman like doing a skill-based sport. But it on paper, you could extrapolate the fact that it could be very effective.
Yeah, no, I like that. And there's so many different, obviously, avenues you can go down as well. I think it's down to us as practitioners in the field, whether that's physiotherapy, strength and conditioning, whatever that is, to like almost create some of these, like look at the research, but create some of these return to play protocols or some protocols ourselves, and then feedback.
With all the CEDA recipients and initial recipients of Airbands, I've personally reached out to a lot of them and asked them those questions, because like they're typically quite elite strength and conditioning coaches, physiotherapists. And I've just said, how are you using it exactly, and what benefits are you getting? Because I think it's just building out that commentary on basically, because the literature supports, like at some point someone has to do something to then study it. Like they say, like that makes sense. It doesn't work the other way around. Like no one in the lab, like someone has to do something and then go, oh yeah, we should study that.
That's the thing. The research is always behind the practitioners at the end of the day. The practitioners are the ones that are doing it in the field and know it works potentially, well, definitely years ahead at times of the guys in the labs.
Yeah, I think there's the art and science to it, I imagine. So
yeah, 100%. So look, Joseph, I won't keep you any longer. I know you're a busy man in high demand. Just one final question here. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch with you, or have you got like social media, things like that? Where can people reach out to you?
Yeah, I'd say the best protocol would be via the social medias, airbandsbfr.com. That's the website, but that's also the social media links. And I'm across all those. If anyone wants to get in touch, I also feel free to drop an email, info@airbandsbfr.com. If there's anything that I can help with in particular, just reach out. But I'm always excited by chatting regarding blood flow restriction training, particularly with like people who consider the usefulness of it. Because I think in 5 or 10 years there'll be the mainstream for a lot of different. The mainstream in terms of application for strength and conditioning, I would say, like a very mainstream sort of application. But thank you again for your time, Chris. Much appreciated, man.
That's all right. No worries. I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks very much. And I'm sure we'll get you back on at some point as well.
Cheers. Thanks again, man.